From the Sky News Centre at 6, Britain's ambassador to the UN at the time of the Iraq war says the invasion may have been legal, but it was not legitimate. Sir Jeremy Greenstock told the Iraq Inquiry he threatened to resign unless a new resolution was pursued over Saddam Hussein's weapons capability. Journalist Andrew Gilligan, who was at the centre of the sexed-up case for war controversy, isn't expecting heads to roll in the final report.
Rather like some of the other inquiries, rather like the Hutton inquiry, frankly, we'll hear some extremely useful and extremely convincing evidence during the course of it, but I think we'll be disappointed by the conclusions.
Hundreds have lined the streets to pay their respects to a policeman killed saving lives in the Cumbria floods. PC Bill Barker was remembered at his funeral service as a loving family man and devoted officer. The Reverend Richard Lee conducted the service.
He was a man who gave himself to the community and had many wider interests, which were all supportive of family life and friendship and other folk, and he is a sad and tragic loss to each and every one of them in many, many different ways.
Two rappers who put a music video on YouTube threatening to shoot witnesses in a murder investigation have been jailed. Ishmael McLean and Rowan Simon from West London wrote the track after the shooting of 24-year-old Jason Johnson last November. Ricky Whittle will compete in Strictly Come Dancing tomorrow. The Hollyoaks actor spent much of the day in police custody facing questions about an alleged assault on a photographer. He was released on bail this evening. The run chase isn't going well for England's cricketers in their third one-day international with South Africa. They need 355 to win. A short time ago, England were on 83 for 3. And there's another twist in the Robbie Williams engagement saga. His proposal to his girlfriend on an Aussie radio station was dismissed as a joke by his people, but the singer's mum Jan says it's for real and she's really pleased. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free.
Welcome back to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. Joining me in the studio here is Ron Stone, who's a Labour councillor for George West, and Martin Summers. Now, we've got another couple of final stories to go through. Billy Quayne is not with us this week, but he'll be, promised, back again next week. Anyway, this first story here, Ron, the battle looms over cost of Bristol's World Cup dream. Now, I imagine, as a city councillor, you've been involved quite a lot in this, because there's been quite a lot of pressure, hasn't there, from the business community in the city to actually get the city council to contribute. It's worth also saying here that this story was on bristol247.com, which is, I think, increasingly important news website run by Chris Brown, who's an ex-Western Daily Press I think he was deputy chief sub-editor there, and he's now running his own website. So it's definitely becoming a website to watch to get the latest news. I mean, he's also quite a fan of the football scene, so he was the first in the city with the news on this particular story on bristol247.com. But what are your thoughts, particularly on this on this particular story? Because, you know, what we're being asked here, council taxpayers, to contribute to a bid which, I mean, I hate to say it, but it may come to nothing, mightn't it?
Well, yes, it might, but I think you've got to look at the bid, and let's be clear, it's got all party support, on the basis that Bristol is often seen as somebody that's missed an opportunity or not tried hard enough or whatever. Now, clearly, in making a bid for the potential for having World Cup matches in Bristol, there is a net cost in the beginning of setting it up, and the party groups have agreed to go down this route. Well, I think you've got to appreciate that the total cost could be 17 million in the lead up to the World Cup, but the potential in relation to the impact on the city and what it would mean if four or five matches were to be held in the city is a potential of 150 million. And I think you've got to look at that in relation to the fact that we are in recession. we are a city that's fighting with all the others in the UK to keep our local economy and people in work. And if you look at the number of jobs that have been created in the previous World Cup in Germany, example, it's been massive. It's hundreds of thousands of jobs. I think it was 185,000 in the whole lot of the last World Cup. And therefore, the potential to the city and its economy, its tourist industry, the taxi and the transport initiatives, local shops, small traders as well as big ones, clearly the hoteliers would do very well out of it. So I don't think it's unreasonable to ask the bigger players to come up with some monies as well as the city council looking for some form of promotion.
Martin, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean,
you a football fan yourself?
I'm more a rugby league man myself, but I can see that you know, it's a necessary for the council to speak with a united voice on here. There's all party support for this. I mean, many events don't happen without the intervention of the public sector. That's what strikes me about this. I mean, we were talking about the football stadium at Ashton Vale the other week, and of course, effectively, the Bristol City Council taxpayers are going to have to subsidise that development. So when people talk about a free market in this and a free market in that, they forget that most of the time, it's a partnership between the public sector and the private sector. Right. And I'm not against that. The public sector is important. But when people say, well, what does the public sector do? Well, what it does is it creates all of the infrastructure for the private sector to do its stuff. And, you know, there's a symbiosis between the two if it's done properly. And this is presumably what we're hoping for in this case, is that Bristol will in the end benefit more. You know, there's an outlay to begin with, but in the end the city benefits more, and presumably that will be reflected in a bigger tax take for the council.
Okay, final story then is the empty fire control centre down in Taunton, which is costing £150,000 a month. There's an attempt going on in the whole of the southwest of England to consolidate all of the fire control centres. That is to say, the people that when you dial 999 and report a fire, the people that answer the call, this is where they are, and they coordinate the fire engines all around the southwest of England as to where they go and what they do. Is the idea is that this will all take place in Taunton, rather than having little centres. I think we Avon Fire and Rescue's centre is up at Lansdowne near sort of Bath direction, and the idea is that these are all going to be done in this one centre. The only trouble is it's been there for several years now, and because of the software isn't working properly, it seems like a bit of a dead duck, and it's costing £150,000 a month. Ron, what on earth is going on?
I wish I knew. Up until May, I had been a serving member of the Fire Authority, right, ever since 1985. And the Fire Authority's position has always been that the central control idea was a total waste of public money. What we've got at Lansdowne and what we offered to central government was the ability of a centre that could handle what they're asking this new control centre to do. There's a fallback situation in relation to major terrorist incidents, and there's a further backup again, which is totally mobile. Now, when that was put up, the ministers didn't even come and look at it. It was a total disgrace. This is a shocking waste of public money, and indeed it's a huge disruption to people that work in the service. There's a loss of local knowledge in relation to issues of when fire calls come in and out, and there's the potential for difficulties. And,
well, that sounds like a really fundamental issue. If you're asking the people down in Taunton to have local knowledge of the entire southwest of England from Tewkesbury down to Land's End, then actually that sounds impossible to me. And this sounds like potentially a step backwards.
Well, that has been the position.
Also, of course, it means the whole fire brigade, all the fire brigades of the whole of the southwest and their communication network is very vulnerable. If something goes wrong in this one spot, exactly, that means that nobody in the whole of the southwest of England is going to be able to respond to a 999 call.
Well, this
what on earth is going on? Can you just explain, please?
I'm getting quite worried
as I read through this story here.
I wish I could, because the logic, and again, in fairness, across all political parties that were on the fire authority, right the way through this whole process, has been that there is no need for this centre in the south.
So what's driving it then? What's behind it?
Well, it was the idea, I think, that centralisation and single operation saves you money. It's the old idea, almost like central purchasing, that you buy a massive thing and the size
of scale
delivers it. What you lose is local knowledge and local flexibility on this. And the fact, and also, don't forget, it's built on a floodplain. So whether it's getting rather wet, I don't know. Whether they've had to pump it out, I don't know.
If the place gets flooded, then again, there will be no response from the fire engines. This is really quite... I mean, because I was working at Avon Fire and Rescue back a few years ago when this was first being talked about, and I remember circulating an email around the entire brigade about this particular software which was being used, and explaining how, I think it was I came across it in a website in Canada or somewhere like that, and they were saying that they actually recommended people didn't use this software because there were all sorts of faults. Now, this is about 3 years ago. Unfortunately, I was only there for 2 months, and maybe that I got told actually not to send these sorts of emails around, even though it was part of my job description. Well, this is my little soapbox and my axe to grind, but I'm making an important point here, I think, which is simply, if there is already evidence out there that this software wasn't going to work, how on earth has anybody been persuaded to run with it? And why has all the public money been invested in this system? I mean, this is actually the one of the most important emergency services, isn't it? If anything really goes wrong, we rely on those firemen to turn up. And they rely, and they're risking their lives, they rely on reliable information from us through the network as to where to go, and also guidance from the control centres. So it seems to me someone here is tinkering with one of the most fundamentally important things that government is doing in this country, and actually still doing very well up till now.
If you look at the other centres and emergency services, the police were going to go down the same route. It's been abandoned. If you looked at aircraft and control centres, that was abandoned. It's a busted flush. It doesn't work.
So, Martin, would you like to comment on this particular story? I mean, I'm getting a little bit nervous, partly because I worked in the business.
Things strike me, of course, is there's a really, really shocking record of buying in IT companies by the public sector. It's not just in the fire service. It's everything. It's the immigration service. It's everything. All of this buying in these whiz-bang IT stuff is all turned... it's all turned out to be... When people used to run things with card file indexes, they knew what they were doing, and now we've ended up with a huge mess. Now, the other thing, of course, is in the relation to the fire service, and I was talking to FBU executive members during the dispute. They were saying that the government keeps banging on about modernisation. They're doing the same thing with the post office. Now, what they mean by modernisation is, why don't we have a cock-up like this and say we're being modern because we've got a computer that doesn't work? And a lot of the so-called modernisation agenda that we're pushing is just knucklehead. What do we actually mean by modernisation? And what the FBU chat was telling me is that what they really want to do is move the fire brigade towards protecting property. So they have big fire stations nearby industrial estates, so that if something burns down, they can get there quick and put it out. Whereas what we really want, if you're really modernising, is you want to decentralise the fire service so you get to that house that's on fire and rescue that little kid. Now, the question is, what is the fire service for? Is it there to rescue small children, or is it there to protect property? And that's what the tussle about modernisation is all about. And professional people like firemen will tell you, if there's a big place on fire and there's somebody's life at risk, then just let it burn as long as nobody's life at risk. We want the fire service to protect lives, not property. That's what we want, to protect property, but that's not the main goal.
Yeah, could I say that the cost of the fire service is roughly about the cost of a Mars bar to people a week. And I think that's the best fire insurance you'll ever have. I've got every respect and total admiration for the people in the fire service, because, as you rightly said, they are the people that, when they go to work to do their job, could end up being killed in what they're doing. We've seen it in this area in Kingswood ourselves. The sad thing is that we've got a training facility linked in with the fire control at Lansdowne that can handle all the emergency training for people in both Gold Command right the way down. It's there, it's already provided, it's been paid for, and it works. And we don't need this white elephant in Taunton.
Well, the question is, why is it still there? I mean, it's been there, I think, something like 3 or 4 years now. This place has been built and then sitting there and done nothing.
It looks like Mr. Prescott is responsible, or Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott.
Come on, John, you were on the fire committee. Tell us why it's still there.
Well, it was there because we were one of the few fire authorities that refused to sign up to it, voted against it, and have always opposed this move in the southwest.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, I have to say. A little bit prejudiced, but anyway. Right, now, Rob, we're going to move on to looking at some of the issues that you've brought up. You wanted to talk a bit about the football bid, didn't you? Can you tell us about that? Because that we've already mentioned it briefly, but can you give us your take on that?
Well, clearly, like I said, Bristol's stood in its own shadow for a long time and almost frightened to move out of it. And so I think the football bid is the right thing to do, particularly in the recession.
But shouldn't we really be waiting until we know that the World Cup is coming here before we before we actually bid and spend money, public money, on trying to make those footballers come to Bristol?
Well, I can understand what you're saying, but there's a long lead-in time, and obviously there are things in relation to the ability to run the World Cup from any city, where you need the transport infrastructure, you need the hotel and tourist support, etc., that still needs to be worked on. And so you've got to be able to know what you're doing and have a clear plan on that. Clearly, it is a competitive element in the fact that, you know, Portsmouth dropped out yesterday. But cities are competing against each other because they can see the advantage to their local community and to their local economy. If you look at some of the facts that were in the cabinet papers, and I've got the cabinet papers here.
Oh, right, you're flicking through them now, yeah.
Yeah. I'll leave these with you if you want to.
Okay, yeah.
During the tournament, this is in Germany, 21 million people travelled to Germany. 18.4 million visited the festivals, that's the fan fest, where the fans are out looking at the big screens, etc. In addition to the 3.36 million visitors that actually had match tickets. Then if you look at Hanover, which is Bristol's twin city, let's take that, I won't quote all of the ones that are in here, had a stadium capacity of just over 39,000, hosted 5 sellout matches in addition. 500,000 visitors travelled to enjoy the matches at that, and the total audience was just short of 700,000 in 31 days of the tournament. Now imagine what you've already seen with the Banksy exhibition, which had 350, I think it was, 1,000 visitors on an expectation of about 100,000. What you would get if you've got that in the ability to be able to provide this tournament in Bristol, and a set of matches and outreach and training facilities. The other benefit is that training facilities, pitches, sports provision, etc., has to be uprated and brought up to highest possible training standards, and they will be remaining behind for local communities to be able to use after. So that's a taste, if you like.
Okay, another subject is the Bristol Britain in Bloom bid and the flower show.
Yes.
So can you tell us what's going on there?
Well, as you know, there's been a debate as to why Bristol's lost its flower show. And that was on the problems and the issues of single independent flower shows and the cost of putting them on.
Can you just remind us where and when it used to be?
It used to be on the Downs, usually in about the middle of August, or towards the end of August. And it was a very popular event, but over a period of time, flower shows in the UK have come to be much more restricted. Taunton have a very successful one, but it's very much more difficult to keep them to actually break even. And the costing of it, if you haven't got good sponsorship and somebody that's prepared to maybe make a loss to give somebody this ability to hold local flower shows, they've gone into decline and then disappeared. The other issue has been that there's been a mounting cost to the city council for 2 years running, where the flower show ended up making a huge loss because of weather like we've had. And then it ended up with the damage to the downs and its surfaces and whatever as well, in the preparation and taking things away. When it was looked at, and I was a member of the Downs Committee at the time, it was decided that they needed to relook at how they would offer a horticultural or flower offer in the city. And what is coming out, there are talks or issues about getting maybe not a single large event, but something more out in the communities on the basis of healthy eating and other things, as well as competitions. And that debate's carrying on. The Bristol in Bloom, as you know, won the National Awards for Tourism and Best City and whatever. And I come from a meeting this morning, which is looking at the 2010-11 issue, in relation to holding on to what we've already got, but making an even greater bid out in the communities to involve even more parts of the city in the Bristol in Bloom contest and the Britain in Bloom contest, because a lot of the communities, particularly in the south of the city at the minute, struggle to be able to get into the examination areas.
Right, you've also mentioned here the Matthew and £25,000
yes.
funding for it to cruise the city docks. That's something I didn't know about. Is this really?
Evening Post. I didn't know about it.
Okay.
So I read about it lunchtime.
Okay, so what's going to be happening here?
Well, I think it's crazy. We've got, as you know, part of the tourist offer, the great SS Great Britain, national winner of exhibition and tourist. Awards. I mean, they only came second to one of the major theme parks this year. And we got the Matthew. And we're also said to, do we have a history in this city? Are we proud of it? Do we promote it, etc.? You know, Industrial Museum and all the debate about what we do and how we present it. So here we got this wonderful replica built in the city docks. Apparently needing treatment to be able to, I think, it keep it watertight, and it needs £25,000. And what I can't understand is, although it's, if you like, it's a trust and it's an arm's length and slightly private issue, it is part of the tourist offer, and the city council has a budget of approaching £400 million, and these people are going to have to ask citizens in the city to pay up to sit on the Matthew and go from the Arno Fini to various points down as far as the Cumberland Basin dock and then all the way back, like on a ramble, if you like, across the dockside, to raise £25,000. Now, that is a minimal amount of money in relation to the tourist offer and everything else we're doing.
So are you saying then that you don't really think the City Council takes its historical heritage seriously?
I think it needs to take a very serious look at how it supports that, and to be much more upfront in relation to supporting issues like this. I don't think these guys should have to be doing this. I think the City Council should come up with that.
But don't you think Barbara Jenk and the rest of her friends there are thinking to themselves, well, hang on a minute, this is a charity. Surely they should be really doing their own fundraising. They shouldn't be asking the beleaguered people of Bristol to dip into their pockets to fund something like this.
I'm not saying they shouldn't fundraise themselves. But I just think they may get concession on mooring in the city and whatever, and that may be the city council's apparent input to the trust. But to me, I think they should be given a helping hand.
Okay, another issue you've raised is the Christmas lights.
Yes.
So are we going to be having as good Christmas lights as usual up Park Street and everywhere else?
Well, where are they? What are they? Are they any good? Are they worth looking at? If you look at my ward, for example, for the last 3 years, we've had better Christmas lights on the shop at the corner of Church Road. It sells car parts, because that gentleman decorates his whole shop with X lights that come from the Blackpool Illuminations, and he does it for charity. He raises money for charity by doing it. A better show, in my view, what's that Park Street and strung round the Cathedral Close, and that's it. We've got nothing on the city centre. I think it's miserable.
So you think, yeah, they need a bit of they should buy some new ones or what?
Well, I think we need a whole new approach to this, and do we mean it or don't we? I mean, we either don't have any lights at all, because I think what we've got is pathetic, to be honest.
Okay, another issue you've brought up here is the budget. Let's get a little bit serious again here.
Yeah.
The budget council tax for 2010, everyone will be wanting to know, is it going up or is it going down?
Well, I think it's going to be a very difficult budget. When we left control of the city council just after the local elections, there was a surplus on the city council's overall budget of £2.5 million. In the time now, between now and today, there's an underlying deficit of £2.4 million. So that's in fact £5 million that's gone adrift somewhere. And the most of that, and the biggest single problem that is emerging out of the budget, is the adult care budget. If you look at that in relation to the aspirations to change and alter the elderly persons' homes and to provide dementia care and to change the patterning of how people are being encouraged to stay in their own home, to be independent, and change, if you like, the whole ethos of elderly persons' homes as everybody understood them. That has had an increasing apparent deficit month on month, and it's going to get even greater.
Well, why is that then? I mean, surely something like old people's homes are going to be costing the same for the city council to be running year after year after year, roughly. I mean, why is it going up?
Well, there's some issues in relation to the programme that was originally produced. If you look in North Bristol, for example, Ben Gough House, which was going to be part of an arrangement, has been dropped as being a potential one for change. And those services are going to have to be moved around or look for an alternative. Now, clearly, all the work that went into costing and looking at that as an option has now been scrapped. And so you've got to start again. What you can't do in this issue is to get your sums wrong or your potential for service delivery wrong, because the people that are in that service are the most vulnerable in the city, vulnerable to change and to pressure and worry, but also vulnerable in relation to their health.
Now, we did have, actually, I think probably 2 or 3 months ago on this programme, a report which was looking at the very little period of time that the appropriate committee at Bristol City Council were given to actually make these decisions. Apparently, the report was delayed and delayed and delayed, and then the committee were asked to sign up to or vote out the report without really having the proper time to look through it. Is that your understanding?
Yes, because I sat on one of the scrutiny commissions, and one of the things I was asking was, what is the real cost and where are the staff changes and all the implications for staff movement and retraining and costings? And there were holes in that, and that is again part of the reason.
So is there any kind of changing in ownership here? Because this is one of the things I'm always a little bit suspicious about. When I see the city council or government generally moving old people around, I want to know why. And often it seems to be that there's some kind of private interest in there, in the new arrangement, or maybe that the council doesn't own the new place, whereas it used to own the old place, and that then can leave the council vulnerable and the city vulnerable to spiralling costs. Can you just, in a nutshell, explain to us? Because I think many people are really concerned about the way that the council deals with elderly people. And also, of course, it's quite a good a sort of dipstick, really, a litmus test as to how good the council is, as to how it treats its most vulnerable people. So can you tell us what's been going on with these elderly people's homes?
Yeah, well, the first thing is it was the attempt to try to get more of the support for people to stay in their own homes. You know, the issue about people having to go into care and then potentially having to sell their house to up their welfare and upkeep. So that there's a non-cost in that, and there is a rising number of people who want to do that. They want to stay independent. They want to stay with their neighbours. They want to stay in the location that they know. And that's perfectly understandable, and I support that 100%. Then there's the problem, because people live longer, that you have to look after people with dementia or other debilitating diseases. And medical care being what it is now, people are living well into their 90s. When sometimes, perhaps, you know, 20 years ago, they would have died when they were 70, perhaps, without this support. Then we've got the issue of individual councils and their budgets in relation to how well off are they? Do they have the capital programme and monies to be able to do this totally in-house? Or do they have to look for a partner because they haven't got that money? And in the main, Bristol is trying to do it in-house. Because the issue in relation to once you go outside of the city council is not only the employment rights and conditions for the staff and what that means to them, but it's also the level of care that is offered in relation to the price offer. And the in-house care is more expensive at the minute than you can buy on the private sector. But in trying to keep... as you say, councils responsible for the elderly people and their residents, there is a cost in that, and that is where it's tied up in those figures.
Okay, so what is actually happening with these various elderly people's care homes now then?
Well, there's a programme that's been brought forward, and Vetchley in St George is one of the major key points, because that was a standard elderly person's home before. And this is being modernised and altered to become a dementia care home, and the ability to give carers some respite as well. Now, unfortunately, that should have been started 3 months ago, and there's been slippage because they discovered some sewage pipes and various other things. They also discovered that we had Japanese knotweed next to us, and that had to be treated. But I am concerned that the major issue of changing the internal structure seems to have stalled. And I have asked questions of the executive members as to whether they're still committed to this project, because this area has one of the highest percentages in the city of people over the age of 80.
Well, who, the executive member concerned, is that Bev Knott chairing that committee?
Yes.
Because Bev Knott is on my black book list, I'm afraid. He's one of the people who has said he'd come on this programme. Actually, what he did do, to be fair to him, was to say that he would look at when he could, and we were arranging for him to come on. And he's since then has said that he's too busy. So I just find it a little bit irritating when you've got people who are in a powerful position like that, an important, responsible position, when they can't find time at all. I was talking about possibly having him on maybe in January, February, sometime in the new year, to come on and talk about what he does. Obviously, these people are busy, but it's just a bit unfortunate that the only other person who we've got a similar reply from on the programme is Dawn Primorolo. But then I think that's partly because she's got a very safe seat. But still, there's only two in my little black book so far, councillors and MPs, so we're not doing too bad. So anyway, what do you think is going to happen with this particular issue? It would be nice to get Bev in and talk to him about it, and maybe I could actually go and interview him about it. But can you tell us what you think, how this is going to pan out over the next few months? Because this does sound like a bit of a mess at the moment.
It's in danger of failing if it's not grasped early enough and something done about it. Vetchley should be in operation by October, November 2010 in its prescribed form now. Whether it will be is the issue that concerns me, which is why I've been chasing the executive members.
But what concerns me as well, of course, is that clearly many of these elderly people have been told about the potential move.
Exactly.
And it's not easy for them to be then told, well, maybe it's going to happen, maybe it isn't. And it just causes worry, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think, you know, it sounds to me like the best thing to do here is just to say, no, you're not going to be moving, and we will tell you if and when you will in the future. But just, you know, just so that they can relax. The last thing you need is a sort of a potential move hanging over your head when you're in that sort of advanced elderly state, because you want to be staying in a similar sort of situation most of the time anyway.
Yeah, you need to keep this type of service change as stress-free as possible. Can I say, just in relation to any executive member, and I'm not picking on the individual that you mentioned, I think the executive members of the City Council have a very important role and responsibility to the 400,000 residents of this city. They do get paid not an unreasonable amount of money for doing that, but they also are responsible for some of the major services to some of the most frail and sensitive, delicate and desperate people in the city, as well as other major general services. They have the ability to stop or make decisions, and they have the ability to stop or make budgets. And I believe in situations like this, that where there are concerns, that they should bite the bullet and come out here and tell people what the truth is. And I think that is the first major role. Now, I've never been an executive member of the City Council. I'm currently a shadow member and executive for a number of posts, including adult care, housing and sport and leisure. But all I would say is I see that as a frontline part. You cannot ignore the people that voted for you, and you cannot ignore and keep them ignorant of what you're doing. If you do that, you do it at your peril.
Interesting. And councillors pay now.
Yes.
So this is the idea, because I mean, traditionally councillors weren't paid. They just got quite generous expenses, a little bit like the MPs maybe. But can you tell us what the situation is with the leader of the council, the council's chairs of the various committees and the ordinary councillors who aren't actually running these committees?
Yeah. In the Aden days, we used to get an attendance allowance for every meeting or one meeting a day that we attended. If you attended six different meetings in a day, you still only get paid one. You had some phone support, and you had some travel support and overnight stay accommodation if you were away at a conference or something, and you may get conference tickets or whatever. That was the old system. What you've now got is a basic pay for all the 70 city councillors, which is standard for everybody.
So how much is that?
That is around £9,000-£10,000, right? And then on top of that, depending on whether you're an executive member, executive members and the leaders get somewhere between £20,000-£30,000, down to I chair the regulatory committee, I get £5,000 for that. But these figures are fixed by an external independent body, and they come forward with recommendations every year as to whether there should be any changes or not, or whether there should be what the inflation increase would be. And in the last three, I think, out of the four years that this has come forward, those levels have been reduced by a corporate vote at the City Council. So we haven't gone down the route of going to the maximum expenditure.
But you see, these amounts of money are nothing like the comparable
nothing
responsibility in the private sector, are they? Why aren't they so, you know, why are they such small amounts for some people with responsibility over the lives of many tens of thousands of people?
Well, that's a good question. But on the basis that if we were to be paid, if you like, the rate for the job, terrible phrase, right? Imagine what the council tax would be, and imagine what local media would say in relation to councillors and a slush fund and snouts in the trough, compared to failure of being able to keep the elderly person's homes on track or whatever. It's a recipe for a disaster. I believe that there is a need to recognise that in For example, my numbers available to people in my ward, 365 days of the year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, okay? And I go out and I see people when they need it in their own home. Now, there is a cost to that, and there is an element of cost in it. And I think to do your job properly, you do need to have some recognition and support, because a lot of councillors may well be working and could lose actual time and money from their major job, which I did over 27 years. I was working at 24 and was a councillor for the university, for example. And there needs to be some recompense for that, because otherwise it's only going to be people that have the wherewithal and the social position probably that could be councillors that goes back to the 20s and 30s, you know, where it was the landed gentry that tended to run local authorities.
OK, Ron, final question now, which you're raising, is the 20 miles an hour zones. Now, car drivers aren't going to be very happy, are they, about suddenly having to slow down to 20 miles an hour everywhere? I mean, 30 miles an hour is fairly slow, even though, of course you can cause an accident at almost any speed. But what's the logic behind this, and is it something you're behind or not?
Well, I got some serious questions about it, because the average speed in Bristol is actually 17 miles an hour. So in one way, you're looking at it, you're speeding it up by 3 miles an hour, hopefully. The real issue is, of course, is to try to control speed and dangers from speed, but also in relation to using it as an initiative to try and get more people onto public transport. Again, sorry to come back to my ward, but if you go up Lippiatt Road, which is about half a mile from here, if you put a 20-mile-an-hour zone on that, which they have, you'd be very lucky, because normally you can only go up Lippiatt Road at about 4 miles an hour because of the double parking, because it's only 25 foot wide. So I think some of the areas that have been picked in the city are crazy. I think within East Bristol, Whitehall Road, Speedwell Road, Whiteway Road, Plumbers Hill, all major accident and speed areas should have 20 mile an hour zones on it, and are not there. And so at the minute, I think it's likely to fail, although it's well intentioned, and I don't think they did enough basic work locally in wards to know where they should be implemented.
Okay, Ron, thanks very much. I think it's fair to say it's been really enjoyable having you in here. Martin, I just wonder if you've got any comments about some of the issues we've been going through, particularly to do with the elderly care homes.
All of the detail is fascinating, but one of the things that strikes me about everything Ron's been saying is there's so many things that need doing in this community, yeah? And we need resources to do those things, whether it's caulking the Matthew or sorting out the problems of the elderly. Now, what we've got to do is, instead of talking about cutting public expenditure, which both major political parties are doing, to my annoyance, we should be thinking about reflating the economy. And that means actually spending money on all of those things that need to be done. And when we say we haven't got that money, we've got enough money to bail out the banks. Now, that's the problem, is we've used all our ammunition in just keeping the private sector banks in the style to which they've become accustomed. Now, whoever wins the next election has got to get their priorities the other way round. The banks and the wealthy are going to have to pay, and we're going to have to reflate the economy from the bottom up. Let's call it trickle up. Let's employ more people in social services, for example. Why not? And people say, well, we can't afford it. I think that's wrong. When you're in a depression, when you're in a crisis, that's your opportunity to get these things done, because you wouldn't in normal times get those things done. But in these times, we could get those things done if there's a will and if the political leadership exists.
So is there a will?
We've got to make such a will. This argument will have to run and run. I mean, you can see what's happened now at the national level. The Tories have said they're going to cut public expenditure. The Labour Party said they're going to cut public expenditure but not by as much. Now, they both need to go back and read their general theory by J.M. Keynes. We need to expand government spending at this moment. We shouldn't worry too much about deficits. We need a bit of inflation. All of these people are talking like what's happened in the last 2 years hasn't happened. We're in a different ball game here, and this is a terrible crisis with all sorts of really frightening things coming over the horizon. But it's also an opportunity to get things done which should have been done years ago, because you've got to actually push the economy forward out of the rut, and that means you've got to find things to spend money on, and we need to find good things to spend money on, not rubbish things like this fire control nonsense. But we need to identify, is the local knowledge that Ron's just shown us, people, local people know what things need to be done. We need to go out and find out from them where the blockages are, where the bottlenecks are, and let's get those bottlenecks got rid of.
Martin, you probably weren't at the CBI's conference last weekend, no. But at the CBI's conference last weekend, we heard that Britain has run out of money.
This is just nonsense. This is just propaganda.
No.
We haven't run out of money. In actual fact, I mean, the Japanese are up to 250% of GDP as their deficit. Yeah, we're actually way down the league in these terms. And in actual fact, this is a new era. By spending like this, yes, we will debauch the currency if you like. The pound will come down. That'll help our exporters. A bit of inflation wouldn't do any harm. We're actually underneath the Bank of England's target at the moment, which is 2%. We're underneath that. We need to spend. And if there is a problem with British bonds not being saleable in the markets, then we will have to raise taxes. But we don't want to raise taxes on the low-income people. We'll have to raise taxes on wealth. And that's logical. The wealthy people have made a lot of money out of the property bubble. They made a lot of money out of the hedge fund bubble, yeah, and all the rest of it. Now it's the time to get their checkbooks out and pay for the things we need. And that will be the way we will get out of the slump as well.
Anyway, Ron, thanks very much for joining us on Friday Drive Time this week. And Martin too. We'll be talking to Martin a bit more later on. And maybe you can hang around for our little feature on Max Kaiser, which is a bit later. But right now, it's Freemasons Hall Craft Fair and Open Day tomorrow from 10 till 3 at the bottom of Park Street. It only happens once a year, so I thought I'd play you one take from the 1970s on the Curious Society of Free and Accepted Masons.
Excuse me, did you say knives?
Rotating knives, yes.
Are you proposing to slaughter our tenants?
Does that not fit in with your plans?
We wanted a simple block of flats.
Ah, I see. I hadn't correctly defined your attitude towards your tenants. You see, I mainly design slaughterhouses. Yes, indeed. This is a real beaut. I mean, none of your blood caked on the walls and flesh flying out of the windows inconveniencing passers-by with this one. I mean, my life has been building up to this.
Yes, and well done. But we did want a block of flats.
Well, may I ask you to reconsider? I mean, you wouldn't regret it. Think of the tourist trade.
No, it's just that we wanted a block of flats and not an abattoir.
Yes, but of course, that's just the sort of blinkered Philistine pig ignorance I've come to expect. Creative garbage. You sit there on your loathsome spotty behind, squeezing blackheads, not caring a tinker's cuss about the struggling artist. You excrement! You lousy, hypocritical, whining toadies! With your lousy colour TV sets and your Tony Jack and golf clubs and your bleeding Masonic handshakes, you wouldn't let me join with you, you black, boring bastards! Well, I wouldn't become a Freemason now if you went down on your lousy, stinking, pullulent knees and begged me!
Well, we're sorry you feel like that, but we did want a golf flats. Nice though the abattoir is!
Oh, the abattoir, that's not important. But if one of you could put in a word for me, I'd love to be a Freemason. Freemasonry opens doors. I mean, I was a bit on edge just now, but if I was a Mason, I'd just sit at the back and not get in anyone's way.
Thank you.
I've got a second-hand apron.
Thank you.
I nearly got in at Hendon.
Thank you.
I'm sorry about that, gentlemen. The second architect is Mr. Levy of Wymas and Dibble.
Oh. Quite frankly, I think the central pillar system may need strengthening a bit.
Yeah, isn't that going to put the cost up?
It might.
Well, I don't know whether I'd worry about strengthening that much. After all, they're not meant to be luxury flats.
No, I quite agree. I mean, provided the tenants are of light build and relatively sedentary, and given a spot of good weather, I think we're on to a winner, yeah?
Yes. Oh, thank you.
quite agree.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
It opens doors, I'm telling you.
Let's have a look at that handshake again in slow motion. What other ways are there of recognising a Mason?
That's Monty Python from the 1970s there, making a bit of fun of the Freemasons. Anyway, what is
Why was that the architect's sketch? One of the reasons I was just looking at why. One of the books on Freemasonry is called The Brotherhood by Stephen Knight. One of the things he explains in there is that they actually have as a what they call a god, whether it's really a god or not, something called the Great Architect of the Universe. So if you ever wondered why Monty Python chose the architect's sketch to have a little dig at the Freemasons, that was why. And also, just to remind you, that's between 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock tomorrow at the bottom of Park Street is the annual Freemasons Craft Fair and Open Day, which only happens once a year. So if you want to go and ask any questions or have a look round, that's open tomorrow from 10 until 3. Percy Faith there was a theme from A Summer Place. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we heard from Wall Street stockbroker, ex-stockbroker, and now financial analyst, Max Keiser, spelt K-E-I-S-E-R. Now, he has a weekly slot, as of last week, on one of the international satellite channels called Russia Today. Here is his report on Barack Obama's Asia tour and the world economy in general. And afterwards, just before the 7 o'clock news, we'll be discussing with Martin Summers some of the implications of what Max Keiser is reporting here.
This is the Keiser Report with me, Max Keiser. Markets, finance, scandal. Yes, the world has changed since the election of Barack Obama. Let's take a look at some of the changes we've seen. Here's an interesting video I'd like to play for you. It's about how the Taliban is being financed by the Americans.
Welcome back to The Ed Show. The American taxpayers, that would be you and me, we are funding terrorism, believe it or not. An explosive new report in The Nation details how U.S. tax dollars are going to pay off Taliban killers to keep them from bombing and shooting at U.S. convoys. Basically, the Pentagon pays the contractors to provide security. The contractors buy security by greasing the hands of the Taliban thugs. The Taliban, kind of like the mafia. They run everything in Afghanistan.
That's right. America, the financing geniuses of the world. Wall Street, the citadel of capitalism, now financing the Taliban. Soon to be traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Symbol T-A-L, Taliban. It's hot. It's an IPO. Goldman's doing the underwriting. You gotta buy it on the opening. It's going higher. Well, yes, capitalism is eating itself in America. Good example of this might be this little story. I see, reported to us from ABC News, that McDonald's is hiring in Guantanamo Bay. That's right, McDonald's is opening in Guantanamo Bay. That's right, while you're being tortured, you can eat a nice Big Mac. Your fingernails are being ripped out and you're being waterboarded while you're enjoying a nice chicken McNuggets. Yes, McDonald's is now hiring in Guantanamo Bay. A lot of change has happened since Barack Obama's been president of the United States. What else is happening out there in the big bad universe of Barack Obama and change? Oh, here's some change. General Electric, world's biggest, oh, I guess, what do you want to call it, a military contractor? They plan to spend $1 billion creating new Islamic bonds. That's right. Sharia law, which is the law of Islam, has guided the Islamic banks through this financial crisis beautifully. They're not going bankrupt like on Wall Street. So General Electric, they're going to start selling bonds using Sharia law. More change we can believe in. Let's go to some of the other big stories this week here in the Kaiser Report. We turn now to correspondent, financial commentator, Stacey Herbert. Stacey, welcome to the Kaiser Report.
Max, nice to be here. I do have some headlines. You know, Barack Obama is in Asia on a 9-day tour of Asia, including Japan, Singapore, China, and South Korea. Well, from Japan, Obama then went to China. And on his flight there, while he was flying there, about to arrive in Shanghai, here are the headlines. China rounds on U.S. rates as global economic risk. China's Liu says U.S. rates cause dollar speculation. And China, loose U.S. policy, weak U.S. dollar, creating speculation. So, you know, Obama and Timothy Geithner have been complaining about the U.N. And one of their goals in going to China was that they were trying to encourage the Chinese to stop intervening in the currency market. So while they're flying there, before Obama even arrives, the chairman of the China Banking Regulatory Commission, Liu Mingkang, warned of a new systemic risk being caused by the U.S. dollar, weak dollar policy.
It's currency wars. This is World War III. It's going to be fought in the currency pits around the world with these countries throwing S&P futures contracts and Forex contracts at each other with algorithmic trading and high-frequency trading versus various bankers and the public. It's currency wars. World War III.
There's Max Kaiser, the characteristic sound of Max Kaiser. Martin, could you just give us your take on particularly on that first item that he mentioned there in this new series that he's doing for the satellite channel Russia Today, about this report in The Nation about the funding of the Taliban?
It's exactly the same as what happened in Vietnam. Of course, what happens is the same thing happened to the Russians in Afghanistan before. Everything is leaky. So you put all this resource in, all this money or whatever, and of course it goes into the wrong hands, because it will do. These are corrupt countries. So the local police that you've trained pass the money on to the Taliban. I mean, that's all good guerrilla fighters try to get all of their equipment from the people they're fighting. Yeah. And that's the way it works. And if anybody imagined it was going to be any different in Afghanistan than it was in Vietnam or anywhere else, or even in Northern Ireland for that matter, would be kidding themselves. So it's not that surprising. That's just the way. It's just throwing good money after bad. There was a whole series of other issues there.
The other one is this idea of Islamic bonds. These big American companies issuing.
It's quite clear that the forbidding of usury in Islam is not a stupid idea. It's quite a straightforward idea.
So just
we've got ourselves into a hell of a mess because we haven't actually recognised what the problem is with money creating other money without some kind of regulatory control.
Well, the church courts in this country actually forbade usury before the Norman invasion
But there's no silver bullet. I mean, we can't just say, well, if we all had Islamic banking, that would be fine. I think the real nub of the report, the sensible bit, was at the end when they were talking about the face-off between the Chinese and the Americans about what's going to happen with the dollar. Most people do not realise that the Chinese communist banks are propping up the capitalist system. And the Americans are being really stupid if they go and try and lecture the Chinese about what to do and what not to do, because at a certain point they may decide to pull the plug on capitalism, and of course they can do that if that's what they want to do.
What would happen if they did that?
Well, the thing is, it's going to collapse anyway, but they could choose the timing of the collapse, and they could actually, they could do it as a tactical manoeuvre if that's what they wanted to do. I don't think they do want to do that. They're as scared as everybody else, but we are in a very, very dangerous situation.
Fascinating stuff. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 and the Somali Youth. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you want a story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Labour City Councillor for St George, West and Chair of Public Safety and Protection Committee, Ron Stone. And also thanks to Marina Morris and Martin Summers. If you're on broadband, you can hear all our previous Friday Drive times, including last week's report on mobile masts and wireless networks, and find out what's scheduled for forthcoming weeks by going to bcfm.org.uk and clicking on presenters or podcasts to find my page. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.